From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Israel and the aid ship for the Gaza Strip. Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Even some Israelis say their leaders fell into a trap, telling commandos to slide down ropes from hovering helicopters into an angry crowd. As the diplomatic repercussions spread worldwide, another aid ship may already be on the way. We'll have updates from the Middle East, the UN, and Washington, where the Obama administration faces another awkward reality. Also today, fears that the Korean Peninsula might be back on the brink of war are easing as South Korea moderates its verbal attack on the North for sinking a South Korean vessel. First up, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. South Korea is showing signs of trying to cool tensions with North Korea, despite the international conclusion that a North Korean torpedo sunk a South Korean ship last month, leaving 46 sailors dead or missing. One of the many unanswered questions, why has China had so little to say? We'll have more on that later. First, this news update. Yesterday's deadly attack on a flotilla of ships bearing aid to the Gaza Strip has produced street demonstrations worldwide in a diplomatic firestorm. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cut short a trip that included a meeting with President Obama. Edmund Sanders is Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Edmund, good to have you on our program.
Hi.
What has the Israeli government had to say? Did Prime Minister Netanyahu himself have anything to say today?
He didn't really. He had a few brief comments defending the raid at the cabinet meeting, but there hasn't really done a press conference or any sort of address. I think he was huddled most of the day with cabinet advisors or trying to work out a strategy for how to cope with sort of the unfolding crisis, both internationally and at home. And I think also it tends, the government often tends to sort of lay low, hoping to weather the storm, letting these things pass, or hoping that they'll pass over before making any big statements. But what has come out of them has been fairly defiant. They basically said they have nothing to apologize for. They stand by the raid. They criticized the UN Security Council statement, which condemned the violence and said they have no plans to lift the blockade of Gaza.
When you say, though, that there is an unfolding crisis at home as well as internationally, what do you mean?
Well, it's interesting. You know, in these kinds of things, often here and probably everywhere, initially the public's very supportive of the government, of the military, of the soldiers, and that was certainly the case yesterday when they released the video images of soldiers being beaten by activists on board with chairs and metal bars and things like that. People were very upset and outraged. But you're seeing the beginnings a little bit now of a deeper questioning. The newspapers today use words like fiasco and flawed policy, questioning whether or not this Gaza blockade is worth everything that Israel's being put through, the damage to its reputation, why this elite squad of soldiers was used in this particular mission, why they were overcome so easily by unarmed activists who took their guns from them. So a lot of questions, some people are calling for the resignation of the defense minister. So that part of the story is just beginning to unravel or evolve.
Obviously, Israel always is a very diverse place in terms of political opinion, and I would assume then that there are people all over the place with different points of view.
Sure, yeah, there's a lot of debate. I mean, generally, as I said, it started out fairly supportive, but I think we'll see in the days, more criticism and more questions being raised. But it also depends on how things go internationally. The more pressure there is from the outside, the more Israelis tend to sort of fall behind the government. Even yesterday, you had the opposition leaders kind of expressing their solidarity with the government in this time. But eventually, it's going to go back to as soon as the pressure is off. If the pressure is off internationally, then they'll start to wonder what to do, especially in terms of an investigation or what kind of action they might take domestically.
There has been a report that another ship is already under sail. Certainly, it is there is a plan for others to sail into Israeli waters to try to break this blockade of Gaza. Does the government have any indication of how it might respond to that?
It says it's going to block it. It's going to intercept it. It's not expected to arrive, I think, until the end of this week or possibly next week. There's maybe two vessels coming. They've indicated that they've learned some lessons, so maybe they'll do things a little bit differently. But they have said they will take the same approach. They will prevent the vessels from reaching Gaza.
What are the apparent alternatives to having commandos rappel down ropes onto the decks of the ships?
It's being debated. I mean, they talked about different ways to disable the ship. Certainly a diplomatic solution was discussed, a compromise. In the past, they've rammed ships. And in the past, they've just let them go in. A lot of people are saying, you know, they should have just let the boat through, possibly, because they've done it several times in the past with smaller vessels. Or a different kind of soldier. These were like the most elite, one of the most elite naval commandos in Israel's security forces, and they rappelled down from helicopters and, in a very sort of aggressive way. And yet, at the same time, they were armed, most of them, in the first initial wave with paintball rifles because they really didn't want to hurt anybody. But obviously, that's not how it worked out because they killed at least nine people.
At least nine, according to the demonstrators themselves, 16. Often difficult to sort these things out this soon after an incident of this nature occurs. So at any rate, I take it that the administration is, as you put it, keeping its head down for the moment and waiting to see what happens both domestically and around the world. We'll hear about both of those things as we continue today. And Edmund Sanders, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, we'll hear from Turkey, from Washington, from Israel itself, and from the UN. At the half hour, after threats of renewed violence last week and easing of tensions on the Korean Peninsula, on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. We just heard that Israel is facing an unfolding crisis domestically as well as internationally because of what happened yesterday when commandos slid down ropes onto the decks of what's referred to as an aid ship for the Gaza Strip, trying to end the longtime blockade of that part of the world. Professor Ilter Turan is a professor of political science at the Bilye University in Istanbul, in Turkey, where today the prime minister of that country called yesterday's attack a bloody massacre. And in Washington, Turkey's foreign minister told CNN that Turkey wants an independent investigation, an apology from Israel, and compensation for Turks who lost their lives.
In this world, all the nations, all the countries are accountable. Accountable by international law. No nation is above the law. Unfortunately, today, some Israeli leaders think that they are not bound by this.
Again, that was Turkish Foreign Minister Ahmet Davutoglu. He is on his way to meet, or was on his way to meet, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. In Turkey, Professor Ilter Turan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
Give us a sense of not only the government's response to this, which has been so outspoken, but also people in Turkey.
Well, what appears to be taking place is an overall sense of indignation over the treatment of a humanitarian mission to Palestine. Now, I think Israel might have been within its right if Israeli territorial waters had been violated. But the way they have handled it in international waters and treating it very much as a sort of huge security risk and therefore landing commandos and sort of firing at the people that were there has produced a situation which most people here, irrespective of political preference, political partisan identification, have found very offensive and unacceptable.
What does this mean for the regime in Turkey? It is said that most of the people aboard this ship, most of the civilians who were killed, were in fact Turks, and that something like 50% of all of the people on board were Turkish as well.
Yes, I think the effort was a Turkish organized effort, but international community was mobilized to extend its support to it. The ship took off initially. It was loaded and took off from Istanbul, and then it was joined by other vessels and was in the high seas when it was seized. I mean, it was actually, the destination was clearly Gaza, and that was not made a secret.
When the foreign minister says Turkey wants compensation for the victims, what form would that take, do you think?
I'm not able to judge. I mean, usually compensation under these circumstances implies a monetary compensation for the families of the deceased, but I'm not able to judge what the government has in mind other than monetary compensation.
And what about Israel's relationship with Turkey, said to be Israel's closest ally in the Muslim world, if ally is the right term?
Well, actually, we had a very close relationship. Sometimes it was even referred to as a strategic partnership. But the first dent in the relationship really came when the Turkish government tried to act as an intermediary between Syria and Israel with regard to achieving a peace arrangement between these two countries. And the Turkish prime minister seemed to be very confident that a modus vivendi had been achieved. And before it could be formalized, Israel attacked Gaza. So the judgment of the Turkish government, the prime minister in particular, was that he had been duped into sort of helping Israelis gain time as they prepared for their onslaught to Gaza. And so the confidence was undermined, and the relationship has been deteriorating since that time. And, of course, this in particular constitutes a watershed event.
Professor Yıldır Turan, a professor once again of political science at Bilye University in Istanbul. Amos Harel is defense analyst for Haaretz. That's the Israeli newspaper we often hear from on our program. Amos Harel, thank you very much for being on our program today.
You're welcome.
Your column today begins with the headline, Straight into the Trap. What do you mean?
I think there's no longer a debate. It was, even in Israel, it's agreed that it was a fiasco, that this shouldn't have been handled this way, and that the results are pretty horrific. What Israelis see different than the Turks and probably than most European viewers is the actual actually what happened on the ship itself. Most Israelis feel that it might have been a mistake to board the ship using such a technique. Some analysts, myself included, have been asking, was it the right thing to do, actually to decide to stop the ship and to continue this blockade on Gaza? But Israelis feel that the soldiers themselves handled the situation quite, I'd say, okay. They were outnumbered once they were there. My colleague has mentioned before, most of them were only with paintball rifles. And once they were attacked, when they boarded the ship, by dozens and dozens of people, not with firearms, but mostly with crowbars and knives and so on, when they felt that they were there was a danger to their lives, they shot. But it wasn't a case in which a direct massacre happened or something like this, like it wasn't an intention by the Israelis to murder Turkish civilians. I think one should mention that five other ships were boarded with hardly any struggle at all.
What happened to those other ships?
Those ships were brought to Ashdod port in Israel. Equipment they had, the food and the medication and so on that was meant to be brought to Gaza. Israel has promised to actually deliver to Gaza. Some people on the ships were arrested, but I think most of them are already, some of them at least, are already released to Jordan on the way home. The people who are still held by Israel are mostly Turkish activists on board that certain ship, that ship where the bloodshed took place, Marmara.
Again, Amos Harel is a defense analyst for Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. I want to go back to Professor Turan in Istanbul. We just heard Amos Harel said that most Israelis don't feel that this was murder, that the commandos themselves behaved the only way they could in self-defense. Your prime minister has said this is murder. Does he mean that in a broader sense than what the commandos themselves did when they were attacked after they got under the ships?
Well, actually, when there's a significant loss of lives, I mean, people may choose to use different words to describe it, but one of the options available is clearly murder. I think the critical point is that the Israeli forces chose to employ a method that was probably the least desirable. I mean, it's my understanding from having talked to military naval officers that there were a number of other options that could have been employed without having to land these commandos on the ship, because in the end the idea was to direct the ships and to bring them under control, and this was the least it was the worst way of doing it.
Well, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Yılta Turan in Istanbul. Again, Amos Harel, back to you. I take it you're saying pretty much the same thing, excepting that you wouldn't use the term murder, but that there were other options that ought to have been employed.
That's true. Other options have been discussed, mostly post-mortem. But analysts in Israel have been saying that the government, the special security cabinet, and also the IDF should have checked other alternatives. One of them is actually sabotage. There were cases not in the last few months, but earlier, before, where some kind of sabotage was made, and the result was that those ships could not reach their destination. There's also the tactical issue. Once those soldiers, those Navy SEALs, used the helicopters and arrived on board the ship, I mean, the numbers were, as far as I know, it was a 4 or 5 Israeli fighters against 40 or 50 Islamist activists, most of them, as I've said, using knives and crowbars and so on. And at such a scenario, I think you can hardly blame the commandos for actually using force. They were only, some of them only carrying handguns. It could have turned much worse. As far, you might find it hard to believe, but from what I've heard, from what the people I've talked to in the last 24 hours, it's pretty clear that in certain circumstances, there could have been a really a huge massacre there. I can't imagine Turkish policemen or Turkish soldiers behaving any differently under such circumstances.
Amos Harel, once again, defense analyst for Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper. Martin Indyk is now vice president and director of foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. He's author recently of Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peace diplomacy in the Middle East. He was ambassador to Israel from the United States in the late 90s. Mr. Ambassador, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much for having me.
What situation or what difficulties does this situation pose for the Obama administration, and what would you expect now from Secretary of State Clinton?
Well, first of all, of course, it's a massive distraction from the effort to try to establish a peace agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians. The indirect talks would just getting underway, and I think the president was about to engage with both Bibi Netanyahu and Abu Mazen in the next 10 days. They were both supposed to come to Washington, and for him to give a major push to that, and unfortunately this is now going to be put, I fear, on the back burner while we deal with the immediate crisis in Gaza. Secondly, it's going to undermine those who are most committed to trying to achieve that breakthrough. Abu Mazen will in relative terms be undermined in favor of Hamas, who now becomes the hero with the spotlight on them again. Ehud Barak, the defense minister in Israel, who is, I think, within the Israeli cabinet, the most important person pushing for movement on the peace issue, has now been undermined and is now facing severe criticism inside Israel itself and calls for him to resign and so on. So it's not just a distraction, it's also potentially a setback to that broader effort.
Amos Harrell, back to you with Haaretz. You indicated that there might be a serious questioning of the blockade, more serious than there has been in the past. Is there any possibility that the blockade might significantly be lifted?
I don't think in the near future. If you follow the President Obama's statement yesterday, he was really concentrating on the need for an Israeli investigation into what happened. He didn't mention so much the blockade. I think we should expect some kind of pressure from the European community. We might be facing another challenge from the Turkish government. Let's take, for instance, a scenario in which the Turks send actually their naval ships with another flotilla like this. It might get a lot more complicated, but I don't see the government right now under this pressure. While the political arena at home supports what happened, supports the army and the prime minister, I don't see the government withdrawing right now and saying, okay, we were wrong, we'll lift the blockade and Hamas can continue going on with what it's been doing in Gaza. I should also mention that from the Israeli point of view, there's a huge question, not only of the rocket smuggling and the rocket shooting every now and then at the Israeli population, but also the question of the abducted soldier, Gilad Shalit, who's been held by Hamas for 4 years with no willingness from Hamas to end this with a deal with Israel.
Okay. Mr. Ambassador, back to the possible United States position, since Israel has allowed ships to go through the blockade in the past, would it be difficult for the United States now, particularly given the international reaction to this, to say it's time to end the blockade or at least to modify it?
Well, the United States has been urging Israel, with some success, to ease the siege, and the flow of goods has increased over time for humanitarian purposes and then beyond that. And I would expect that we will see more of that take place. That is, while the siege will formally stay in place, I think that the flow of goods will increase. But I don't think that the Israelis are going to open the way in these circumstances to ships coming in, because that would be kind of like, from their point of view, I suspect, opening the floodgates. Over the longer term, I think that United States is going to be concerned about how to get out of this situation, which is now, you know, such a public relations disaster for Israel, which is causing deep strains in the relationship between two allies of the United States, Israel and Turkey. And the United States has put a lot of effort into building that relationship and trying to prevent it from deteriorating in the way that it has now. And so in basically trying to find a way to sustain an effort to prevent Hamas from firing on Israeli civilians from Gaza, I think the United States is going to look for a better way than the current arrangements.
Ambassador Martin Indyk, thanks to you. Amos Harrell in Israel, thanks to you as well. We're going to go to the UN next, and we'll deal with this situation as well as what's going on the Korean Peninsula in a moment on To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point. Last week it appeared that North and South Korea might be tilting toward a resumption of hostilities. In a moment we're going to have updates on that situation. First, though, we want to finish our report on what's happening with regard to Israel and the commando attack on the aid ship to Gaza. Colm Lynch is United Nations correspondent for The Washington Post, also writes the Turtle Bay blog at foreignpolicy.com, and it's always good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
We heard earlier the reference to the UN Security Council and its condemnation of Israel. What's been the reaction beyond that at the United Nations? Is anything further expected to take place?
No, essentially what's happened, and it's sort of interesting, the statement actually doesn't call for direct condemnation of Israel. It calls for a kind of more muddied, ambiguous condemnation of acts leading up to the incident. So there was a bit of a fight over how strongly to go after Israel before there had been a sort of thorough investigation in the case. But essentially what everyone's focusing on now is the question of, you know, what is the next step? Is there going to be an investigation into what happened? Who is going to conduct it? The statement that was passed after about 11 hours of negotiation in the middle of the night called for an impartial, credible investigation into what happened. The language is fuzzy enough that the Palestinians are reading this as though there is a need to have an international UN-related investigation into what happened, and the U.S. and the Israelis saying that, no, this will be an investigation that will be carried out by the Israelis. And so, you know, essentially what's going to happen is that all the focus is going to turn to how that is going to play out, how credible this investigation, which I presume would be conducted by the Israeli government, would be. And then also, you know, will we see Turkey, which is very sort of unsatisfied with what has what has come out of this UN process, you know, will they come back to the Security Council in the coming weeks, months, to continue to try to mount pressure on Israel to, you know, ensure that they hold people accountable for what Turkey believes is an international crime.
And Turkey has made it very clear it wants an independent investigation. The ambassador to the United States, the foreign minister, before going in to meet with Hillary Clinton, said we want this to be independent, not conducted by Israel. So we'll see some debate about this, no doubt.
Right, right.
Now, an independent investigation was what led the international community to conclude that it was a North Korean torpedo that struck the South Korean ship last week. Interesting that China at the UN was very quick to condemn the Israeli attack on the aid ship, said it was shocked and appalled and demanded a quick response from the UN Security Council. But it's been days since North Korea was found to have sunk that South Korean naval vessel, killing 46 South Korean sailors, and China's reaction has so far been ambiguous. What, Colm Lynch, do you conclude from that?
Well, I mean, I've had some sort of informal conversations with the Chinese, and my sense is that they continue to see any action in the Security Council as sort of exacerbating an already delicate and unstable political situation. You know, their view is that bringing it to the Council, pushing for tougher action, increases the prospect that these two governments might, you know, sort of turn to armed conflict, and that they want to continue to play this role as a kind of honest broker between the North and the South. So they have been taking a quite sort of, you know, again, an ambiguous position about the merits of the investigation that was carried out by the South Koreans and the Americans, and they're not willing to, you know, formally endorse those findings. It was kind of interesting. The UN Secretary General, who's also from South Korea, used to be their foreign minister. Usually when there's a dispute among the big powers in the Security Council, the Secretary General stay out of it, and they don't get into the middle of it. But Bonn has sort of been kind of, you know, carefully, cautiously putting pressure on the Chinese to apply pressure to take action against the North for this attack, says that the evidence is overwhelming and convincing, but it hasn't been sufficient to it hasn't been sufficient to persuade the Chinese. So in the meantime, everybody is just waiting for the South Koreans to show their hand. They haven't formally tabled a resolution that they're going to put before the Security Council. The Americans are not very aggressively pushing this. They're waiting to see what the South Koreans do. So I suspect that the South Koreans will have to come with something, but they're not going to be able to get very much out of the Chinese, I don't think, in the Council.
Again, Colm Lynch is UN correspondent for The Washington Post. Let's go to Seoul, South Korea, where Don Kirk is the correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Don Kirk, good to have you on our program.
Right. Good talking to you again.
What is happening in South Korea, not necessarily just with regard to the resolution in the UN, but what has South Korea had to say today that might indicate whether or not it intends to become more or less bellicose about what the international community has concluded was, in fact, the sinking of its ship?
Well, I think South Korea really wants to cool it, actually. South Korea is maintaining that it will demand an apology and punishment for those responsible and all that. But nonetheless, clearly South Korea wants to pursue a diplomatic course, doesn't want to risk more clashes, not that they won't happen, but it does not want to invite more clashes. South Korea has said that it won't do those mega-loud speaker harangues that it was going to do, and it's not going to drop the leaflets over the North that it was going to drop. It obviously doesn't want to incite or provoke the North into carrying out its threat to fire back at the loudspeakers. So the whole emphasis here is on cooling it and on diplomacy. This in the wake of Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao's visit here over the weekend, in which he clearly was not going to commit China to one side or the other. At the same time, emphasized the desire that I think he said the urgent need for stability and for calm.
Again, Don Kirk is in Seoul with the Christian Science Monitor. Quickly, Colin Lynch, back to you at the UN. What would you conclude from that about what might happen at the UN?
Well, I'd conclude that not much is going to happen.
I
mean,
like
I would think that it's going to be very difficult for the South Koreans, though, to step down from its previous sort of commitment to come to the Security Council. So I don't know how they kind of manage this, and I think that it's got to leave relations with the Chinese fairly raw, that they have been very, very eager to get the Chinese on board to support some sort of respectable response to, you know, what is an act of war, and you know, here they are being made to look rather weak. So I don't know. I think politically it's going to be a little difficult for them to get through this without having something to show for themselves here.
Well, Colin Lynch, as always, thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
UN correspondent, Washington Post, also writes the Turtle Bay blog at foreignpolicy.com. So back to Don Kirk in Seoul. If, in fact, South Korea looks weak, as just was suggested, this is, if, in fact, it had occurred as the international investigation concluded, an act of war, what does this mean domestically in South Korea?
Well, I was trying to interject a question while
I'm sorry.
Still on the line. What I was wondering was whether or not there's a possibility of something like a statement of condemnation or something or other going through the Security Council from which China might simply abstain. I suppose the UN correspondent is no longer with us, but I people here say, well, maybe China could abstain, maybe Russia will abstain, and so somehow face will be saved. But you know, I'm not saying that there's any possibility that will happen. I'm sort of wondering if there's a chance of that. Now, to get back to the question about what's going on in South Korea, actually there are elections, local and provincial elections coming up, polls opening in a few hours, and we'll get a sense from those polls, although they're local elections, we'll get a sense from those polls as to how popular the government is, how well received is its investigation, in which it's totally blamed North Korea for torpedoing the Chonan on March 26th. Surprisingly, there are quite a few people here who actually don't really want to accept the government's report. They say that President Lee is exacerbating tensions with North Korea, that they kind of wish they could go back to the sunshine policy of reconciliation of the previous two administrations. Now, those people may be in a minority, but some of them are quite outspoken. So South Koreans are not speaking with one voice on this. So it'll be interesting to see in these elections whether they're a reflection of real support for the government or whether there's some obvious opposition to the government's position.
Am I wrong to have concluded that the investigation was, in fact, an international one? Was it just conducted by South Korea? I thought an international body had concluded that there was language written on the remains of the torpedo and that the torpedo was, in fact, a North Korean-style weapon. Is that right?
It definitely right. Now, it wasn't and it wasn't an international investigation. It was a South Korean investigation, but they had experts, real experts from half a dozen other countries, including the U.S., Sweden, Britain. I don't want to list countries and then make some be slightly wrong in one or two of them, but I think there was someone from Australia, Canada. I'm not sure if I got the list totally straight.
But it had credibility beyond just what South Korea was saying.
Well, it did. The U.S. had a rear admiral who was an expert on this sort of thing. So some people are saying, well, that, you know, that gave it credibility. Other people are saying, yes, but these, most of these countries, not counting Sweden, were allies of in the Korean War, and so maybe they're biased from that point of view. Well, to cover that you know, point of skepticism, shall we say, South Korea is urging Chinese and Russians to do their own investigation, and a four-person team from Russia arrived in Seoul today, and there's talk that China may send a team too. Now, the one team that South Korea is not welcoming is North Korea. North Korea said that it wanted to send a team, and South Korea made clear that the North Koreans were not welcome on this investigation.
Don Kirk again, a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor in Seoul. Victor Cha is a senior advisor and Korea chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, professor in the Department of Government at the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He was director for Asian Affairs at the White House from 2004 to 2007. He's author of Nuclear North Korea, a debate on strategies of engagement. Victor Cha, good to have you on our program.
Thanks, Warren. That's an awfully long introduction.
Well, it is, but you're a distinguished person, and we had to tell people that. Next time you come on, we'll be more abbreviated. What do you think, and where does this leave the United States? But before we get to that, I guess, what conclusion would you draw from South Korea's behavior in the last couple of days? Are they really trying to tamp things down?
Well, I think that they basically stayed consistent, which is that after, you know, a pretty egregious attack by the North, in which, you know, the press says 46 sailors were killed, but they were clearly trying to take the whole ship down, well over 100 sailors. The South Korean government has responded not in a sort of a knee-jerk, belligerent fashion, but never accused anybody, did the investigation, and then has largely put forward diplomatic measures to try to deal with this, bilateral sanctions, U.S. ROK naval exercises, and then probably going to the Security Council. This news about their pulling back on the decision to put to restart propaganda, which has taken place between the North and the South since the end of the Korean War. The South stopped it, but the North has still kept doing it. This decision to pull back on the decision to restart it was, I think, simply a case where they thought, you know, well, is this really going to give us the sort of impact that we want it to have as a measure that would be helpful in terms of deterring the North from doing this again? Because from a policy perspective, that's what you want to accomplish. You want to deter the North from doing this again. They probably reached the conclusion that it wasn't the sort of thing that would help, whereas a Security Council resolution, and in particular working on China, whether that's at the Security Council or behind the scenes, that's where the action needs to be. That's where I suspect the action will be, whether it's in the U.N. or outside of the U.N.
Now, back to this issue of the propaganda. We've heard a couple of ways of propagandizing. One of them is to have enormous loudspeakers on the border, as I understand it, and loudly broadcast material. The North said that they would fire into those speakers if that happened again. The other is to drop pamphlets. How far into the country does the propaganda actually reach?
Well, it just reaches across the demilitarized zone, yeah, and would largely only affect those who are manning the border, possibly getting as far as the city of Kaesong, which is a city that sits in this demilitarized area between the North and the South. I think what they talked about was a combination of simply broadcasting world news, which I don't think many people would see as propaganda, and playing South Korean pop songs, which are extremely popular throughout all of Asia, which I don't think many people would see as propaganda. And the leaflets are something that NGO groups have already been wanting to do for quite some time, where they send up leaflets that just have information about the outside world that they hope will float in to parts of North Korea so that the general public could get a better sense of what was going on from the outside. You know, the only strength of the North Korean regime since its start has always been the weakness of the people. And these are simply ways of just allowing the people to get a better sense of what's going on in the world.
Again, Victor Cha is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Mike Chinoy is with us. He's author of Meltdown, The Inside Story of the North Korean Nuclear Crisis, senior fellow at the U.S.-China Institute at the University of Southern California, former senior Asia correspondent and Beijing bureau chief for CNN. Long introduction for him as well. Mike Chinoy, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
Tell us a little bit more about Kaesong and what has transpired there, where there are factories that employ North Koreans but which are owned by South Koreans.
Yes, Kaesong is a city just on the northern side of the demilitarized zone, and it has been the showpiece of North-South economic engagement with this economic development zone. You described it correctly. The South Koreans have funded and set up factories where North Koreans work and produce products. And what is very, very interesting, even as tension has increased very sharply in recent weeks in the wake of this sinking of the naval vessel and then the South Korean report, which clearly shows that the North Koreans did it, neither the North nor the South have taken the ultimate step of pulling the plug on Kaesong. For all of the angry rhetoric, all of the threats and bombast coming from Pyongyang, all of the warnings from the South that we can't be pushed around, both sides have not yet scuttled this project. It's still operating. It's very uncertain. Its status is still obviously uncertain because of the overall situation. But that suggests to me that neither the North nor the South has an interest in this situation escalating completely beyond control. And indeed, I think the greatest danger of escalation is likely to come from a small incident that triggers something larger or spirals out of control rather than either side seeking to start something big.
Why would the greatest threat come from a small incident rather than an act of war, trying to sink a naval vessel, as was pointed out earlier, with 100 sailors on board, 46 of whom were killed?
Well, I think there's a context here, and without making any moral equivalence between the South, which is a vibrant democracy, and the North, which is a horrible and brutal dictatorship, the context in which this sinking happened, in my view, can be traced back to 2007, when the previous South Korean president went to the North and signed an agreement aimed at trying to reduce tensions in these disputed waters. And when the current South Korean Prime Minister Lee Myung-bak took power, he and his government moved away from the policies of previous governments that were focused on engaging North Korea, and as part of that said they weren't going to honor the agreement. And so I think you had on the southern side an attempt to move towards a tougher line towards the North, and of course the North didn't take that very well, and it's in that climate that you've had some previous incidents, most notably last November when the South Koreans got the better of the North in a naval clash. And I think there's I think it's my own view is that the North sinking in March was payback in the typical North Korean style. You hit us once, we hit you twice and twice as hard.
Don Kirk, back to you in Seoul. Would this explain what you were talking about earlier, or does it add some depth to what you said earlier about the difference of opinion politically in South Korea?
Well, partly. Certainly, you know, a lot of people just don't like the government of President Lee, and almost there's almost a sense of nostalgia for the decade of efforts at sunshine and reconciliation. So people tend to think that way. It may be a minority, but it's a significant minority. People who tend to think that way tend to pour skepticism on the report. The report is pretty convincing, actually, and the investigation, I think, has even the opposition Democratic Party, most leaders of it, fairly convinced. But nonetheless, you know, the hostility toward President Lee, the conservative President Lee in some quarters, definitely skews the way people look at the results of the investigation. And as for the incident in the Western Yellow Sea, obviously that had a lot to do with a long-running dispute between North and South Korea over the legitimacy of the northern limit line, which was set by the UN command after the Korean War. That was really set as a line above which, I'm told, above which South Korean and American other ships were not supposed to go. But it's become a line below which North Korean ships are banned. So it's very much of a disputed sea border, and very interesting confrontation out there, which could erupt any time.
We're going to take a very brief break. We'll be back with Don Kirk in Seoul, Victor Cha in Washington, and Mike Chinoa as well on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Olney back with our last segment today of To the Point. Don Kirk in Seoul, I said you'd be here for the rest of the program, but it's 4 o'clock in the morning in your part of the world. You've been very kind to be with us, and I'm going to let you go, and maybe you can get some sleep before you have to get up and start working again. Thanks so much for being on our program today.
Right. I'm glad to be with you.
Victor Cha, let me go back to you at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Do you agree with Mike Chinoy that the fact that Kaesong, where the factories are, has been kept open is pretty indicative that neither country really wants this to escalate beyond where it already is?
Well, not entirely. I mean, I think the South Korean government, in response to this sinking, this attack on its ship, basically said they were going to cut off most bilateral trade with the North, with the exception of Kaesong. Kaesong constitutes 60% of inter-Korean trade today. So that was a significant sign, not so much that they were afraid of escalation, as much it was, I think, a nod to 10 years of sunshine policy and leaving open the door, leaving open a very symbolic project to the North to show them that there is a future there in case the North Koreans are interested. I would characterize the South Korean government's policies, the current government's, not so much as walking away from engagement that the previous 10 years of South Korean governments undertook. Instead, they simply said, we want to engage with North Korea, but we would like to get something in return. In other words, the past 10 years of Sunshine Policy, as it was then called, was really a form of unconditional engagement where the South would provide things to the North with the hope that in the longer-term future, the North would reciprocate both in terms of denuclearization and inter-Korean cooperation. The new South Korean president comes in. He's a former businessman. He says, you know, if I'm going to invest South Korean taxpayer money into North Korea, I would like to see a return, particularly in terms of denuclearization. And as a sign of that, he sent out very clear benchmarks of what he would do to help the North Koreans if they headed down this road, including the increasing of their income per capita to $3,000 a year, which would have been huge for the North Koreans. So I don't know if it was so much walking away from engagement or more it was simply asking for more equitable terms of engagement. But Mike is absolutely right. The North Koreans did not like that because for 10 years they got very used to unconditional engagement in which they would receive things and have to provide very, very little in return.
Yeah, Mike Chinoy, what do you say to that?
No, I think there's an element, a strong element of truth in that. But I do think that part of what the South Korean government did when Lee Myung-bak took over was, in effect, to try and rewrite the rules of the game of North-South engagement in a way that the North saw as both unilateral and, in particular, in the North Korean system, where the leader is effectively God, you had these two North-South summits, one in 2000, and with the architect of the Sunshine Policy, Kim Dae-jung, going up from Seoul to meet the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-il, and then another in 2007 with the previous president, Noh Myung-hyun, who also supported the Sunshine Policy. And when Kim Jong-il puts his, you know, gives his endorsement to these kinds of initiatives, the perception in the North, if you try to sort of get inside their heads, is that the new South Korean government was kind of sticking a finger in Kim Jong-il's eye by very publicly proclaiming we don't feel ourselves bound by this and that we're going to lay out a whole set of new terms, and if the North comes along, then we can play ball, but if they don't, we won't. And I think that is one of the contributing factors to where we are now, and I think it'll be very interesting internally in South Korea, particularly after these local elections, to see where public opinion comes down and to what extent there is support for continuing this tough policy, to what extent there is pressure to modify it, to what extent there's pressure from the right to get even tougher.
Earlier, Colin Lynch at the UN said he didn't think there was going to be much action there in this context. Victor Cha said he thought there would. Mike Chinoy, what do you think? Will this ultimately be taken there, particularly with the Secretary General himself being of South Korean descent?
Well, the South Koreans have made clear they want to go to the UN, and I think the Chinese are really the key players here. The Chinese have obviously, as Colm indicated, made clear they're not going to sign on to some blanket condemnation of North Korea. What I think will be interesting to see is whether or not the Chinese essentially leverage their willingness to support some kind of criticism or condemnation in return for pressing the South Koreans and the United States to recommit to either six-party talks or to the broad notion of diplomacy and dialogue over getting discussions on a broader peace process for the Korean Peninsula started. The Chinese keep saying they're interested in calming the waters, literally and figuratively, and reducing the danger of escalation. And so we don't know the answer, but it wouldn't surprise me to see the Chinese essentially name their price for supporting some kind of statement at the UN as being the South and the Americans indicating a willingness to get back to direct diplomacy with them.
Okay. Mike Chinoy, once again at the University of Southern California, U.S.-China Institute, formerly with CNN. Thanks to you. Thanks to Victor Cha at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Don Kirk in Seoul. We'll be talking about Israel and its situation tomorrow on To the Point. I'm Warman Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast by PRI.
Public Radio International.